Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to episode 3 of Stage 9, Trek FM's show about the people who make Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And today we have the second part of our interview with Deep Space Nine writer David Mack, where he's going to be telling us all about his other short story, Midnight Rider, from the book Out of Tune, Volume 2. But before we get started, let's touch on some, well, I don't know if we can really call it news. It's kind of old news at this point, but something which we haven't had a chance to talk about yet. And something which I'm very interested in, since we've talked about a lot of the people who are working on this and what that means, the trailer for Star Trek Beyond.
Yes, I want your reaction. I've not actually talked about this with you. I've been dying to. Your reaction, the first time you watched it, at the end of it, what came into your mind immediately?
The first thing that I thought of, honestly, was, wow, there's a lot of shots of things which are very familiar to us, which were photographed in ways which I've never seen them photographed, and mm-hmm. have really made me look at those things in a different way, from a different perspective. Mm-hmm. I know that sounds completely weird. I know, like, most people are like, well, this story beat means blah, 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 blah. But to me, I don't know. When I'm watching trailers, I don't usually even really pay attention to what they're telling me about the story. I'm usually mm-hmm. taking them in, like, just visual information, you know, like mm-hmm. in sort mm-hmm. of an abstract way. And that was the first thing that came to mind. Other things have come to mind since, but that was the first thing that came to mind. Like, the shot that really sticks out to me is where the camera is right in front of, like, the deflector dish.
Yes.
And you see the nacelles behind it.
Yep.
And I'm like, are they really that close together? That's weird. Like, that seems just wrong, you know? And it's because we've never seen the ship from that angle. I've never yep. seen a shot like that before.
Well, that shot hit me, but also for me, and other people have cited this too, but the shot of them going through warp, where yeah. it looks like it's pushing waves of space, is, for me, like, you know, growing up with the rainbow tail effect, and then seeing it turn to that sort of, stretchy explosive effect with, you know, with Next Gen, like the warp, the warp effect is sort of stagnated a little bit through time and everything. But to see it like that, like, to sort of represent that warp feel, like, that shot, well, I was like, oh, that's so cool. Like, I loved seeing that.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's just interesting, like, seeing it at that scale. Like, we never really see the ship in warp. I mean, you do occasionally, like, in the last two JJ-verse movies, but it's always, like, at a fixed point with the thing, like, barreling yeah. right by you. But this is, like, such a massive scale. We're seeing so much space that you don't really see what happens. And it looks really cool, yeah, for sure.
And I also want to say that, thanks to you, I paid special attention to the costumes after becoming a Fast and Furious fan. And the weirdest thing is, I think everybody's raving about, like, how they like how the costumes look and everything. But for me, the collars, the way that the collars flare up the back and everything, for me, that is that, I know this will sound weird, but that's that weird little semi-futuristic look that I'm like, it makes me sort of like, yee, that's like when they changed the collars for Deep Space Nine. I was like, ooh, that looks cool. Like, it's yeah. weird, but that's my thing, man.
I have to say that I'm, like, the one guy, I think, who looks at those costumes and is like, oh, nah, I don't really dig them.
Oh.
Like, I really like how the ones that were in the last two movies were sort of, like, modified versions of the original series, and almost, like, turned into something which was more wearable. Like, it felt like they're more practical than what we've seen
oh,
in the past.
See, the
and
thing
these
is, oh.
seem like way too formal.
No, see, for me, these, I'm not talking about, like, the coats and everything. I'm talking about, like, just the shirts that, you know, the regular shirts that they're wearing, that, you know, the blue and the gold and everything, like, those, and the way that the lines are, like, to me, that looks like an athletic shirt. That looks like the type of shirt that, you know, it's functional, but also, you know, if you need to like run really fast, it's going to work for you. And it's, you know, I don't know. But they, I hope they release them
like
as running shirts.
Those like shoulders that have like the, you know, tailored sort of like sport coat shoulder things.
No, you see, you're thinking of like the Franklin coats. I'm not talking about those. I'm talking about like the everyday Star Trek shirts.
Yeah, they feel like they're, you know, I don't know. I don't like them.
Well, you're wrong.
I mean, I'm not going to be like, you know, screw this movie. I'm not going to see it. Their shirts look stupid.
Not my but, Star Trek.
But I mean, like, if someone were to be like, these are the uniforms or just these are uniforms, I'd be like, okay. But, you know, comparing them to like what we just saw, I think what we just saw is a lot better. But,
disagree.
Fair enough. So what was your initial reaction to the trailer when you first saw it?
It's really weird. My first reaction, even though I'm sitting here talking about like the visual stuff that I really liked, was I didn't know how to react to it. I know that that's going to sound weird, but it was sort of one of those things where it hit me and I processed it on an intellectual level and I was like, oh, that looks really cool. Oh, that looks neat. But in terms of the cohesive whole, I didn't have an emotional reaction at first. It wasn't until like my third viewing when I sort of relaxed and kind of saw it for what it is for me, actually did pay a little bit more attention to things like, you know, McCoy and Kirk sitting there with a bottle of scotch talking and, you know, talking about that. And then seeing the ships, you know, attack the Enterprise and, you know, for all of the things that people say about the Enterprise being destroyed and, you know, oh, it's a go-to and the self-destruct and everything, you know, honestly, this will be the third time in how many years that we've seen the Enterprise destroyed.
32 years. That's not a lot.
No, it's not. And, like, I think it's a completely valid thing. Like, I don't want another ship almost gets destroyed and rises up through the clouds, which they did in the last two movies. Like, once is cool, twice is like, yeah, okay. This time, and if they're going to destroy the ship to strand them somewhere, I'm all on board for that. Like, I love the fact, because Lynn has also talked about it. He's like, this is going to get to, you know, stripping them of all of their advantages, and they're going to have to actually just work as people together. I'm like, that's what Star Trek is about.
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, they've talked about this, but, you know, based on the, you know, what we're seeing in the trailers and everything, it really seems like this is sort of like a deconstructionist view of Star Trek. You know, by deconstructing it, we're going to look and see, examine what it is. And with Simon Pegg writing this thing, I mean, we've seen that he does that time and again with his movies to stellar results. I mean, yeah. Shaun of the Dead, that's what it is.
Hot Fuzz,
that's what it is. You know? So, yeah, he's good at that. He's really good at that. And I like the idea of doing that. It's kind of an offbeat, weird choice for the 50th anniversary because they're not going with iconography. They're going with, like, the heart, the soul, what it is that makes Star Trek Star Trek and why we love it. And it's not because of the way the Enterprise looks, or it's not because everyone is on the bridge. It's because of other less tangible things. And I think that that's really interesting. It's bold. It's a bold choice, you know, but I'm curious to see what'll happen for sure.
Well, I'm very curious to see how it pulls other people in. Like, I think you're right. It's a different choice and it's a gamble in a sense, because in a sense it speaks more to the fans than it does to a general audience. Even the trailer feels like it's speaking our language as opposed to being what I think got the JJ verse into a little bit of trouble with the first two, which was, you know, to reach out to the non-fan, right? It feels like they pulled the wagons in a little closer on this one based on the trailer. I mean, you know, that's my take on it. I mean, after the first trailer, all of the fans were complaining that they were trying too hard to reach out to other people. I don't know. Maybe this trailer is constructed in such a way just to counter that specific criticism. I don't know.
Could be. I really do like the style in the trailer. You know, we talked about, you know, the different angles and everything like that, which I think is, you know, very much obviously Justin Lin bringing, you know, his little stamp, you know, to this. You know, I mean, it's not like anyone is going to write that type of thing into a script or whatever, I mean, that's exactly what a director does, is, you know, come up with ways to shoot things and stuff. So that's total Justin Lin. But the other thing which I find really interesting watching this new trailer is, you know, the way that the aesthetic mirrors what we've seen in the JJ verse. He is trying to make it fit with the other two movies. I know people are going to complain about the lens flares, and they're there, and I love it. And, I mean, this looks like it was shot by JJ, you know, and Dan Mendel, and it's not. And I like that continuity. It's cool.
I don't think it looks like it was shot by JJ specifically. But it feels like it was constructed with the same sensibility, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. The shot you're talking about, where it's from the deflector dish, I wouldn't expect to see that in an Abrams movie. And the approach to warp, I wouldn't expect to see in an Abrams movie. So it feels like just a twist on what has come before. Like, it'll fit, but it'll be different enough that you know that somebody's put their own stamp on it.
Yeah, I agree with that. Just one other note about the credits in this trailer, which is very interesting. In the initial trailer, Roberto Orci, John D. Payne, and Patrick McKay were listed as writers in the credit block, even though, you know, everyone involved with the project made it fairly clear that their script was not used, and it was really, you know, Simon Pegg and Doug Jung who, you know, wrote the movie. So they're gone now from the credits. You know, I guess the Writers Guild agreed with everyone else and they're no longer credited. But one person who is now credited, who wasn't before, at least not in this capacity, is Lindsay Weber as producer. She is a Bad Robot producer who has worked on a number of their productions, but her first producing credit was for 10 Cloverfield Lane. And now this is her second one. And I've heard JJ talk about Lindsay Weber in the past, and he's, you know, gushed over her, you know, talent and everything, and basically said that, like, she's the one who keeps the ship afloat, you know. While he's off making Star Wars movies, she's the one who's managing things like 10 Cloverfield Lane and Star Trek Beyond.
And I also want to point out, I think this is important, because on Commentary Trek Stars, we covered a movie where she was associate producer, Morning Glory.
Yeah, we did.
So all it sounds like all of the times that we have raved about how when you go to a Bad Robot or J.J. Abrams produced movie, you know, I know it's going to look good. I know it's going to be good quality. It sounds like she is responsible for a lot of that.
Yeah, for sure. And it seems like she's taking a much larger role in the company as well. So that's cool.
Yeah, it is.
All right. So, last week, we spoke to David Mack about his short stories, specifically about his short story, Our Possible Pasts, from the book 2113, which is a short story compilation of stories based on songs about Rush, or inspired by Rush.
By the band Rush, yeah.
By the band Rush. Yeah, and his story in there is called Our Possible Pasts, and he told us all about that last week, and you can find it on Stage 9, Episode 2. But he also talked to us about his other short story, Midnight Rider, which is from the book Out of Tune, Volume 2, which is another book of short stories based on songs, in this case, ballads from like the I guess 18th and 19th century.
Yeah.
And he did a story which is based on one of those ballads. And here is the second half of our interview in which he tells us all about it. With the Rush thing, I really, and I mean, this isn't something that I brought up before, but I listened to the song before reading the book. And then I read the book and then listened to the song again. And it was weird because I was not seeing the connection to the song while reading the book. But, and like, even to the point of like, I had to say to myself, okay, let me listen to this again and see if I can see it. And as soon as I turned the song on, I'm like, oh my God, how could I have possibly not seen that in the book, but because it really sort of brought that out, and it made me reflect on what the song was. But with Midnight Rider, it really seems like a different scenario. For one thing, I was not really clear on the connection to the music in specific for this, you know, collection. Like there's the ballads, but is there also like a contemporary music aspect to it? I mean, the fact that your title is Midnight Rider. I mean,
no,
it's just, no. That's just
the original title right up until I think, we were in copy edits and production was Ghost Rider. But I felt that was a little too on the nose and was going to be a little bit too much like the Marvel character. And I thought, let's get away from that one. Midnight Rider, again, it's kind of, you know, an almost an inside joke. There isn't a connection to contemporary music, but yes, it does reference a well-known song title from anybody who's listened to, I believe it's that Leonard Skinner I'm thinking of? Or
The Allman Brothers, right?
Allman Brothers, right. Allman Brothers Band, thank you. And because I know the song, so I guess that was part of it. Just like the Rush story, Our Possible Pasts is a nod to Your Possible Past, which is a song title by Pink Floyd off The Final Cut.
Oh, that's just, oh, yeah.
Right. So, of course, yeah. Kevin J. Anderson caught that immediately. He's like, you know, it's like, oh, I see what you did there. Very nice. Very nice. And he, of course, had asked me to change that story's original title. The original title for years on the time travel story was Mulligan, which is a sports term from golf for a do-over. But he felt that was a little obscure and also just not evocative. But once I hit upon Our Possible Pasts, he liked that one a lot better. But with Midnight Rider, partly it was just A, to avoid the association with the Marvel franchise, and B, to evoke the song Midnight Rider by the Allman Brothers Band. But there is no other contemporary music connection beyond that. I was really just working off of the ballad lyrics to the Suffolk Miracle. And obviously, I don't expect your listeners to be that familiar with it. So to recap briefly, this concept of the Suffolk Miracle is you've got a woman who is well-born. She has a suitor who is slightly less well-born. The father of the woman objects to the marriage. And so he moves the daughter away so that she won't be tempted by or run off with the suitor. While they are separated, the suitor, through some set of circumstances, dies. But then his spirit appears to her, says, come ride away with me. She rides off with him in the original ballad. And then he complains of a headache, so she gives him her bandana. He ties the bandana with like herbs around his head, but then he takes her back to her house. He says he's going to go stable the horses, but when they go to find him, he's not there. The carriage isn't there. And then when they dig him up later, I think he's got the bandana on his head or something. Like, they find her bandana wrapped around the head of the body, which is buried many miles away. And it was some weird kind of thing. I'm looking at this story, trying to figure out, what's this about? What is the lesson here? I like the sort of creepy notion of the, you know, she gives the ghost the bandana and the bandana winds up on the body, but I wasn't seeing it add up to a story. I said, that doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't pay off. I don't feel like anybody has learned a lesson. I don't feel like there's a narrative arc. Nobody has grown. Nobody has changed. The situation doesn't feel like we've advanced anything if you just follow that original narrative. So I thought, all right, I'll take the element from this that I like, which is something from the, you know, physical world, the material world, being transposed into the grave through its connection with the spirit world. But then I changed what it was and the circumstances of how it got there, and I made it into a morality play. One that you're no doubt have comments on.
Oh, yeah.
Sure, yeah. Yeah. I mean, do you want to give just sort of a brief synopsis or setup for what the story is, just for those who haven't read it?
Sure. By comparison to the Suffolk Miracle, the main story of Midnight Rider is a guy named Dylan Marsden has only one child who's ever survived through the years. He's a very wealthy, successful rancher in North Texas in the 1890s. His only child is a daughter, and she is the apple of his eye. And so he's very invested in finding her the right husband, because whoever marries his daughter becomes his son-in-law, and by default is going to inherit his land, his wealth, his cattle, his legacy. His legacy depends on marrying his daughter well. And his daughter's name is Hallie. And Hallie thwarts her father's plans by falling in love with one of the ranch hands who happens to be a Cherokee. And this does not go well with Dad when she brings the guy home. And profanity is used. Racial epithets get involved. The man is hounded from the house. Hallie is locked in her room. Father realizes, okay, I've got to nip this problem in the bud. He basically goes and tries to buy off the suitor. That fails. He resorts to murder. And then the premise essentially flows from there of the ghost coming back to get what it feels rightfully belongs to it. And so it is this tale of love denied, love betrayed, love avenged.
What I enjoyed most about the story, I'm not going to lie, is that this feels like the type of story that my dad would have read to me, or that I would have read with friends around the campfire. And I mean that as the highest possible compliment. This would have been a story where at the end we'd have been like, oh, this is cool. And it just, you know, like there are so many things that you do extremely well in this story that, as an adult, it's so much harder to get that sort of creepy feeling from a story like this, right? You know, like a ghost story doesn't have the same effect, but you do. You really, the portrayal of the ghost is so evocative of those old tales that I loved so much growing up, that like it took me back to that time. So huge kudos on that.
Well, thank you very much. I mean, that's really what I was going for. I mean, I won't lie, I'm not very experienced as an author of horror or supernatural fiction. It's not my usual wheelhouse. I don't claim that it's what I'm best at. But really, all I really hoped I might get out of this was a story that emotionally made sense on its own merits and was able to use some of these supernatural elements, including the imagery related to white owls as they are regarded in Native American mythology, without necessarily disrespecting those original myths or cultures and without being guilty of appropriation.
Structurally, I don't know, I've been watching a lot of Twilight Zone lately, and structurally it reminded me a lot of like an episode of the Twilight Zone, you know, that sort of like...
Oh, wow, thank you. Well, it makes sense. I've recently, a couple of years ago, on Netflix, I binged rewatched the entire original Twilight Zone from the 60s, all six seasons. I just watched all of it.
Wow.
It's easy to do, right? I've been slowly working my way through over the past few months, but yeah, it definitely felt like that. But like inside the story, the language that you use and sort of like the rhythm and stuff like that feels very much, I mean, not just, part of it I think is that you're trying to adopt a lot of the, you know, the terminology which would have been used back then. But in addition to that, it almost feels like it has like a certain like lyricism which one would associate with the era. Was that intentional?
Absolutely. I tried stylistically to make this story feel appropriate to its period. And I wanted to try and find some verbiage that I felt right. I tried to avoid any descriptive turns of phrase that I felt would have been anachronistic based on the point of view of the characters. So I tried to describe things when I used metaphors. I tried to use metaphors that characters of that time and place would likely have resorted to or would have been familiar with. Also, I'm a big fan of various types of Westerns. I grew up, loving movies like Shane and John Wayne's The Shootist. But I also love Unforgiven, and I love Deadwood, and Silverado is one of my favorites. High Plains Drifter, Pale Rider. Mm-hmm. So I've definitely had this template in my head for this very Western patois of a story, and I knew exactly how I wanted it to sound and how I wanted it to feel. I was writing some of the dialogue, particularly the father's dialogue, hearing the voice of an actor named I think it's Walton Coggins. He was on Justified. He played the bad guy. Very eloquent, well-spoken guy with a Kentucky drawl, and he's just a fantastic actor. And so he was my voice template for the father. And there's an actress who played opposite him on Justified, and so I was sort of imagining her voice for Hallie. And once I sort of had those voices in my head, it made it easier for me to say, would these words sound right coming out of those actors' mouths with the way I know their accents sound, with the way I know he tends to have kind of a slow burn in the way he lets his words roll out, that kind of a thing. Yeah. So I would do the dialogue. I would read it out loud to myself that way and say, does this sound like something that someone of that idiom would actually take the time and trouble to say?
Yeah, you know, I haven't seen Justified, but you know, he was in The Hateful Eight, and he was amazing in that movie. And you say, with hearing that now, I can totally see him in that, you know, sort of like voice, you know, that's, or that his voice in that character. That
particularly in the negotiation with Joseph, when he's negotiating with Joseph.
Yeah.
If you hear Walton Coggins' voice as the father, that scene becomes chilling.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. That's really interesting. Okay, so setting it in that time period and everything, you know, makes sense. Was there a particular reason or inspiration for, you know, the subject matter, you know, making it about, you know, race relations in America, I guess, maybe even today, you know?
Well, it's definitely a topic that never seems to get old in America, and it never seems to get resolved. As far as my choice of setting, it was just really the first thing that occurred to me was to go with the weird Western concept. And part of that was that in order for a story like this to work, you have to be able to strip away a lot of the modern world, and you have to take away a lot of obvious avenues of recourse to justice. You couldn't have a situation where, you know, this story could not have played out this way in a modern day setting. It would have been very difficult in the modern world to make this work and not have it all just go to hell for Dylan Marsden, you know, with the law coming down on him. But if you take him and you put him in very sparsely populated North Texas territory in the 1890s, where the nearest law is maybe a week away and only if somebody bothers to send a telegram for it, where basically justice is made at the end of a gun and the landowner pretty much is an undisputed authority. Now you've got a situation where the only real recourse to justice, and you know, Hallie ends up sort of praying to this, is divine power or natural law or whatever you want to say it. And Hallie at one point, you know, she doesn't even know which mythology she's praying to. Is she praying to Joseph's gods or hers? Mm-hmm. All she knows is she has been wronged. Her love has been denied and betrayed, and she wants justice. She wants the matter set right. And in that setting, you know, if you give a character other options, then the immediate question of the reader is, why didn't they just do this? In a modern setting, it would be, why didn't she just call somebody? Why didn't they just run away? This, that, the other thing. If you isolate them geographically, personally, if you basically make them, you know, alone against fate, you know, man against man, man against nature, etc., out in a wilderness frontier type setting, you take away a lot of easy outs, and that increases the drama. It increases the stakes all around.
It is true that, you know, even just like the past, let's say, 10 years with the prominence of cell phones, that a lot of stories, you know, even recent stories can't really be told anymore just because of technology. It's bizarre.
Yeah.
You got to find ways to take cell phones out of the equation in a lot of stories. I've seen a lot of stories where, you know, they start relying on things like the bad guys are using cell phone jammers, which are real technology that, you know, you can get, you can actually order the darn things off Amazon. But writers have to start thinking in terms of taking away easy avenues of recourse, easy outs. You've got to not only take them away, you have to explain to the audience in a very economical and entertaining manner that they've been taken away. You've got to use it to ramp up the narrative tension. But yeah, I mean, so that was part of why I chose the Weird West setting, is that I felt that stripping away technology and easy outs allowed me to tell a better, more engaging story.
John, you know, in our notes, he had an interesting question about, you know, the form of short stories and what it's like to work in that.
Yeah. What are sort of the pros and cons, you know, when you're approaching it? Like, is there something that's differently or especially fulfilling working in the shorter format? Like, do you feel that you have a little bit more freedom to work out some of these themes in a short format like this, as opposed to a novel where you might feel obligated to bring in other subplots? And is it just a matter of these are just two different exercises and they're both fulfilling just in their own way?
I would say it's more the latter. Each has its rewards, each has its drawbacks. In the case of the short story, the advantages you have is that because you are working in a short format with a short word count, you tend to tell a more focused story. It tends to be short stories tend to favor more intimate tales. They also tend to be more forgiving of stylistic experimentation with things like, you know, working in first person point of view. First person point of view can be a very difficult thing to sustain over the length of a novel. There are certain novelists who are very good at it. I'm thinking immediately of Richard Kadrey and his Sandman Slim books. He is amazing at it. But it's hard, because I find that when I'm writing something as long and as complex as a novel with multiple threaded plots, I like to be able to switch between different points of view. And I find that that is often less jarring for a reader if done in third person. It can be done. You can switch between different first-person points of view in a novel or even a short story, but that's high-level writerly, you know, difficulty, you know, trick right there. That's like, you know, professional on a closed course, do not attempt, because you've really got to nail the character voice of each point of view perfectly so that they are distinctive. You have to be able to, you know, be reading, and then when it switches gears, know instantly without even being told, oh, I'm in the other guy's point of view or the other character's point of view. Mm-hmm. If you have to explain it to them, then you failed. So that's why I tend to shy away from first person point of view in novels most of the time. Whereas I was able to use it in the Rush story in Our Possible Pasts. I chose to go with third person in Midnight Rider because I wanted to switch back and forth between the point of view of the father and the daughter. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to get into a whole rigmarole of trying to distinguish the character voices for first person. So I just felt that third person was more effective in that sense. But in terms of like just the types of stories you can tell with short stories, if you get maybe, you know, depending on the word count you're working in, if you have to come in under 7,500 or under 5,000, depending on what the editor wants, I have to think in terms of, well, how many scenes does that equate to? You know, how many individual story moments do I need to get this idea told? And I'll say, well, you know, let's say I need 10. Well, I'm like, okay, well, that means each one has to be 750 words or less on average. So as a result, in a short story, every word has to count. It has to be perfect. You have to be able to say, does this word need to be here? Does this sentence really need to be here? Could I have said these, you know, these three lines of dialogue, could I cut it down to one and still have the scene work? You're always cutting in a short story because the last thing in the world you want on a short story is surplus verbiage, as opposed to my answer to this question. whereas in a novel, surplus verbiage can be the thing that helps you get your word count for your contract and finish the damn thing. But I find that, you know, with a short story, you've really just got to whittle away and find perfect words at every opportunity. Whereas with a novel, you've got the time to explore ideas, and you're not always cutting, although it's usually a good idea to cut as you go along. But that's a whole different story.
It seems like kind of a similar process to writing an hour of television.
Very much.
Yeah, that's interesting. So, okay, I know you've done a ton of Star Trek books, and I know that you had the original novel, The Calling, which we talked to you about on our other show, which is very good. Everyone should check it out, by the way. Do you have any other short stories that have been released?
No.
Okay.
I did some short fiction for Star Trek in the past. I wrote a humorous piece called Waiting for Godot, or How I Learned to Stop Moving and Hate People. And that was in the New Frontier anthology, No Limits. That came out back in, I want to say 2003. I could be wrong about that, but I think it was 2003. And I did some novellas for the Star Trek SCE series, which was later renamed Corps of Engineers. And I did a short story called Twilight's Wrath for the Tales of the Dominion War anthology. And I did a short story called For Want of a Nail in the Star Trek Mirror Universe anthology, Shards and Shadows. So I've done some short fiction before for Star Trek, but Our Possible Pasts is actually my first published piece of original short fiction, and Midnight Rider is my second piece of published original short fiction. I don't have any others in the works, although I have ideas that I've jotted down for possible stories that I might explore. I need to, you know, try and get them out to magazines or to the online fiction markets, because although I love anthologies and anthologies pay well, it's very hard to get your stories in front of the people who need to see them if you want to sort of get noticed for, you know, awards purposes doing anthologies. It's just nobody reads the damn things is the problem. As far as what else I've got in the works, I've got an original trilogy of novels. The series title is Dark Arts, and the first book is called The Midnight Front. And I've been working on that for years at this point. I made the deal a year or two back with Tor Books. And I'm supposed to meet with my editor, Marco Palmieri, in about a week and a half, give or take. We're going to go over his notes on the manuscript for the first book, which I turned into him last year. And we're going to discuss a rewrite. And then I'm going to try and get a rewrite done over the summer. And if all goes well and I execute the rewrite to his liking and I get it done when he wants it done, my hope is that Midnight Front may be out by next fall of 2017. So fingers crossed, knock on wood, hopefully that will work out and we'll have something new to talk about.
Excellent. Yeah, I mean, I can't wait for that. In the meantime, yeah. You've got another Star Trek book coming out next month, right?
That's correct. On July 26th. I'll have a book called Best Defense. It's part of the Star Trek Legacies trilogy. The first book is out, I think, very soon in maybe a week or two. And that is Captain to Captain by Greg Cox. And the third book in the trilogy called Purgatory's Key is by Kevin Delmore and Dayton Ward. And that's going to be out at the end of August. And these three books celebrate the 50th anniversary of Star Trek. They are set in the Star Trek of the original series from the 1960s with the classic versions of Spock, Kirk, McCoy, the Enterprise crew, the Enterprise. We bring in some familiar faces from Star Trek's television past. And it's basically kind of a big sprawling alternate universe, political story, but also a character story and yada, yada, yada. It's all in the back covers.
It should be great, you know. I mean, hey, 50th anniversary, yeah. You know, cool stuff for sure.
It was a fun project. I mean, getting to work again in a collaborative manner with Greg and Dayton and Kevin. I mean, the four of us have been friends for a long time. And Dayton and Kevin and I, you know, had the pleasure of working together for years on the Vanguard series and the Seekers series. And it was actually, I think, Dayton who started ginning up the idea of doing something for the 50th anniversary. And he's the one who kind of got the band together and got us all working on it. And we pitched it. And we're just all very glad that Simon and Schuster and CBS liked what we pitched and gave us the thumbs up.
Excellent. Excellent. Should be cool. Great. So, well, thank you very much for joining us. Where can people find you on the internet and such?
Oh, well, they can find me, first of all, at my website, davidmack.pro. That's davidmack, M-A-C-K, .pro. If you want to find me on Facebook, you can find my official author page at facebook.com/thedavidmack. And if you want to find me on Twitter, I'm David Allen Mack. That's David Allen, A-L-A-N-M-A-C-K. David Allen Mack. That's my handle on Twitter.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And yeah, you're more than welcome back anytime to talk about anything you want. We'd love to have you.
Well, thanks for having me on the show. It was a real pleasure coming in to talk about my original stories. They mean a lot to me. In terms of, you know, sort of being my first foray into original short fiction. I'm very proud of both stories, and I hope that despite the fact that they are locked away in anthologies, that people will find them and enjoy them and talk about them, and I hope I get to do more of them.
Well, that was really cool talking to David about those two short stories. I think that they're both really good, and I highly recommend people checking them out.
Yeah, very, very much worth your time. Get on out there and read them. They really are excellent.
Just to sort of recap, the first one, Our Possible Pasts, can be found in the book 2113, Stories Inspired by the Music of Rush. And the second story, Midnight Rider, can be found in the book Out of Tune, Book 2. And yeah, definitely check those out. You can get them for the Kindle. You can even get 2113 on Audible, and you can also get, you know, paper copies if, you know, you want to be all 20th century about it.
And antique-y about it.
So definitely check those two things out, and thanks again to David for joining us to talk about these.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Well, it's been fun talking to David about his stories. But that's not all we're talking about here on Trek FM this week, so here's a look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Ready Room.
We've been waiting so long to cover material, and it's still not covered yet, and now we might go to the complete other extreme, and let's just jet through it all as fast as we can.
Damn you, Brian Fuller. You've given us too much Star Trek too fast.
The Orb.
You put your action figures on the table or whatever in your house, you know, they don't move, you know.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. I've got one of Picard right over there, and when he doesn't do what I want, I put him in the box, and I put it in the cabinet.
Straighten your shirt, Picard.
Warp 5.
The Romulans had their ship in Season 4 that had the holograms that made it look like any other ship. So you could theoretically retcon Minefield into saying they were using that same technology back then.
Literary treks.
One day I'm cutting the grass.
Nice.
And, you know, you let your brain wander while you're cutting the grass. And I started stitching a couple of the ideas together, and I thought, well, wait a minute here. There might just be a novel.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out these shows and find out what we've been talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us on Apple. If you do use iTunes, be sure to subscribe because that really helps us out. And while you're there, leave us a rating and a review. No one's left us a review or a rating yet. You could be the first.
And we will read the review in the character voice of your choice. You name it, any Star Trek character, we will do that voice for you.
By we, he means him.
Somebody. We'll figure it out. Get us the review first.
But yeah, yeah, definitely help us out there. But if you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find us on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone. I think we're on Google, right?
Yes.
I've never used Google, but I think we're there. So yeah, check us out for sure. Just go to wherever you you found us here. I mean, you obviously found us if you're listening to us, right? Maybe you downloaded it directly from the website. Whatever. You'll find us. And thanks for listening.
Yes, thank you.
Also, thank you very much to our associate producer, Jeff Sutter, who has been an associate producer since the very beginning of this show, 3 weeks ago.
Yes.
But he jumped on board before our very first episode, and we really appreciate him doing so. And yeah, if you want to become an associate producer, you can by becoming a patron of the network on Patreon.com. If you go to Patreon.com/TrekFM, that's Patreon, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and more. I mean, one of the things which is really popular is the Patrons Roundtable, which everyone gets to participate in if they so choose on a monthly
lively
basis.
Discussions on those.
Yeah, for sure. So head on over to patreon.com/trekfm and help us out. We really appreciate it. Okay. If you want to contact us, you can just send us an email directly at comtrackstars@gmail.com, or you can tweet us at TrekFM, or you can find us on the Babel Conference, which is the TrekFM listener discussion group on Facebook, where we talk about our shows and various other things. So just type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it'll come right up, and ask to join, and we'll let you in. All right, John, where can people find you on the internet?
Kessel Junkie, usually on Twitter. And you can also find me co-hosting Words with Nerds, a podcast with my pal Craig, and co-hosting Aggressive Negotiations, a Star Wars podcast over on the Nerd Party Network with Trek FM's own Matthew Rushing.
And you can find me right here on Trek FM, producing From There to Here, Trek FM's daily rewatch of the entire series of Star Trek television shows.
Every last hour. Yes. Everyone.
Yeah, we're in season 6 of Next Gen. We're about to hit season 1 of Deep Space Nine. So, yeah, check it out for sure. It's fun. You never know who might show up on that show. So,
and
yes.
And some of the discussions have been really, really cool. It's been really good getting all of the different perspectives from everybody on those shows.
Absolutely, absolutely. You can also find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K. All right, well, that's it for this week. Thanks again to David Mack for joining us. And next week, we're going to be talking about the newly produced audiobook version of Harlan Ellison's original screenplay for The City on the Edge of Forever. ¶¶